Welcome to Detroit Opera's Opera Here podcast. This is Arthur White coming to you from the Detroit Opera House. We are thrilled you have joined us today as we take a look at the opera The Cunning Little Vixen by composer Leos Janacek. This will be the first time Detroit Opera has presented The Cunning Little Vixen in our 53-year history, and today we will speak a bit about the opera's background, what we can expect to see in this production, and hear from three special guests at the heart of bringing this production to the stage here in Detroit. The Cunning Little Vixen opens May 11th and runs through May 19th at the Detroit Opera House. The Cunning Little Vixen is a three-act Czech language opera by Leos Janacek, completed in 1923 to a libretto the composer himself adapted from a novella by Rudolf Testolídek. Human and animal worlds collide in Janacek's enchanting, cinematic, modern fable about a clever vixen who tries to outwit her captors. The production uses playful projections to transform singers into forest creatures with handcrafted animations to evoke the fable's comic strip origins. The opera fuses brilliantly the aesthetic of live action and animation on our stage. I am so thrilled to welcome two of the forces behind Detroit Opera's production of The Cunning Little Vixen. The first, Roberto Kalb, the current music director at Detroit Opera. He first bowed for us as conductor in Ricky Ian Gordon's opera 27 during the 2017-18 season. And after this production, he goes on to make his debut at Santa Fe Opera in Donizetti's L'Isle d'Amore. And our second guest is the Gary L. Wasserman Artistic Director here at Detroit Opera. He debuted with the company in Twilight Gods at the height of the pandemic in 2020, and his artistic star has continued to rise ever since. Welcome Yuval Sharon and Roberto Kalb. Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So happy to see you, Arthur. Thank you for arranging this conversation about such a wonderful opera.
Thank you. So I turn to you first, Yuval. This production of The Cunning Little Vixen began with the Cleveland Orchestra back in 2014. How did this project come about? How did you come up with this concept? And why was it time now to bring it to Detroit 10 years later?
Well, you know, The Cunning Little Vixen is an absolute masterpiece that I was so surprised when I took on the role of artistic director of Detroit Opera. Not only had Cunning Little Vixen not been done at Detroit Opera, but we have never done the work of Leos Janacek, which to me just felt like an enormous corrective was needed to be put in place immediately, because Janacek's music has to be really among the very best, most, you know, most sumptuous, most kind of also funny and strange and unique in the entire operatic literature. I mean, I don't know any other composer who set operas based on things like comic strips, as in the case of Cunning Little Vixen, or science fiction stories, as in the case of another one of his operas, The Macropolis Case, or other kind of fantastical situations with characters traveling to the moon, going back to the 16th century, or adaptations of Dostoevsky thrown in there as well, for good measure. He really had such a remarkable and unique view of what opera and music drama really can be. And so it is high time to be introducing Detroit audiences to this exceptional music. And Cunning Little Vixen is a production, the production that I did of it in 2014 at Cleveland Orchestra. So it's been 10 years now. The idea behind that piece was a slightly more concert setup in which the orchestra was fully visible. Some people call that semi-staged. I've always really hated that term because I always think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing something in concert. And if you're going to do a little bit of staging, why not do all the staging? You know, like go for it all the way. Like these half measures is something I couldn't quite figure out. So I went all the way and really fully staged Cunning Little Vixen. But, you know, because it is based on a comic strip, and because all of its characters are members of the animal kingdom or the insect kingdom, so to speak, you know, the non-human population of a forest, it made sense to really go back to that original inspiration of Janacek's and go back to animation and think about kind of comic strip approach to it. also to spare our singers from needing to do the embarrassing thing of portraying foxes and vixens and badgers and the like in ways that most often end up making them seem really silly and making the piece seem silly. And I actually think that the piece is so deep and so profound, even while being hilarious and whimsical and perfectly suited for audiences of all ages, it nevertheless carries so much life wisdom in it that I wanted to make sure that we could create a production that allowed people to access that and not get caught up in, well, she wasn't that believable as a fox. Like, I would hate for anyone to walk out of a performance of this piece and be caught up on that kind of thing. So it started in Cleveland Orchestra. Since then, it's gone on to a number of places, including opera houses. It was done both at the Vienna Musikverein. It was the first time a fully staged opera was done in that beautiful hall. And it was also done at the Staatstheater Karlsruhe in Germany as a staged piece. And it was just about to be done in Sweden when the pandemic hit, you know. So it has been seen in some operatic houses. And it just felt like, you know, Cleveland being so close that the material could get to us really easily. And like I said, kind of correcting this this omission in our repertoire by presenting Janáček, all of that felt very important.
Fantastic. Roberto, I have to bring you in. Tell us, had you had experience with Janáček's music before now? And or if it was, or this particular piece?
Actually, I've been a fan of his music forever, I mean, since I can remember, and especially his symphonic music, actually. And I had no experience conducting any of the opera, but I had conducted the Sinfonietta, and I'd studied a bunch of his pieces when I was studying composition, too, because he's such a master composer, but also a master orchestrator. And it was on the bucket list, and when Yuval and I spoke about possible pieces that we could do this season, this was very high up there for me because I really adore his music.
When I first heard that the opera was going to be in Czech and not translated into English, as you sometimes will see it, I happened to be reading about Janáček's credo that musical sounds are derived from the pitches and the rhythms of speech. So then I realized that I guess this had to be in Czech. It couldn't have been any other way unless I'm wrong.
It just depends on your philosophy. I believe that especially this particular piece is so colored by the language and it's so, very difficult to translate. Even after the premiere of the piece in 1924, there was a German translation, like the one that's used around. But even Janáček was very hesitant about using it and was very controlling on the way that the language was adapted. And he was never really truly happy with any of the translations of his music. It just sings in a very different way in Czech, and I'm really excited for our audiences to get to experience that color of the language.
Yeah, I mean, on that topic, something that I find so alluring about, I do not speak Czech, and when I staged it the first time, I had to have a very good book by Tim Cheek, who will be also coaching us on this particular production since he is at University of Michigan. So it's so fantastic to have his guidance with this language. I nevertheless realized something that is maybe a little bit of a cliche, but I should just mention it because I think it is useful, which is, you know, the idea that Janáček, like Béla Bartók, like Igor Stravinsky, loved using folk music or loved using the kind of music from his own village, you know, in his operas. And that he was, all of those three composers and a lot of other composers at the beginning of the 20th century really did believe that modernism was going to be rooted in a kind of real fidelity to a local color. And the realization of that color was something that they were incredibly passionate about. And I think that's part of what makes Janáček in the Czech Republic such a hero, you know, because what he does to bring out of the natural rhythms of Czech, you know, the idea that folk music derives from the way that the language is spoken, you know, that the melodies come from the accents and the scansion of the language is really, really important in the case of Janáček. And so as difficult as it is for our singers, I actually don't think it's hard for our audience to listen to it because it does end up coming out like listening to folk music. And in many ways, how the orchestra always plays with the vocal lines, it doesn't make sense unless you do it in Czech. You know, like the music itself really doesn't even compute, you know, in so many ways. Because, you know, the character will state something in the Czech with a kind of folk melody or create a kind of rhythm. And then the orchestra picks it up and the whole rest of the scene is structured based on that iteration, that utterance of the character. And so if that's not correct, the whole scene doesn't even make any sense, you know. So we're going to be working hard. I know our children in the children's chorus, there's a wonderful little scene for the children's chorus. They have been coaching the Czech for months and months now, even though they are on stage for about 3 minutes.
That's how it is.
Yeah.
You all, I want to go back to some of the visual aspects of what we're going to see on the production. You collaborated with Walter Robot Studios to design and animate the entire opera. So there's animations of doors strategically placed within the set. There's sort of an old-fashioned sort of amusement park-like photo stands where people sort of poke their heads through the cutoffs. Could you tell us, like, how did you sort of help to transform this into sort of this cartoon strip that you were speaking of?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The concept for the production actually really did start with thinking about those things you see at the beach where you put your head in and your body's transformed. And it's so charming to always kind of, and you know, who hasn't taken a picture where it's like your face, but you're in the body of a beetle, or you're in the, you know, like in a, like a surfer, you know, like you're suddenly a surfer because you put your head into this two-dimensional thing. So I really did want to play with the difference between two-dimensionality and three-dimensionality in this production. And the animation that Walter Robot created, I absolutely think is so perfect for this piece, because what they did is it was all digitally created, but from handmade objects. So all of the sets that you see in the animations were actually often, they created models out of cardboard and then did digital paintings on it. So it has both a real hand, like a handiwork to it. You can really see the artist's hand in it. So there's an old-fashioned element of the aesthetic, but actually the animations themselves came about through digital technology. So it's got both a kind of new and old quality to it. And for the singers, I really did want to create this experience where there's the kind of illusion of two-dimensionality, and then their faces popping through the animated world as something that kind of lifts the life of these individual animals for the most part. The characters that are not animals are almost exclusively in front of this animation screen. And for me, the idea behind that is what I think the piece is actually all about, which is, you know, we can't help but think of nature. Very difficult for us to not look at nature and not anthropomorphize it, meaning we always see ourselves in nature. We give human characteristics to animals by default, right? And we see them and we think that they must be like people that we know, or that the animals' versions of sociability have to be exactly like ours. And I think that the opera really jokes about that. Like, you know, there are some very strange little details in the piece that only make sense if you think it's because we can't help but look at nature, and maybe it's part of our, and it's probably to our deficit, actually, a deficit of our imagination, that we can't imagine nature being different than us, you know? And yet, on the other side of it, when we think of nature as a projection screen, as a projection of our fantasies and our desires and our fears, then we can learn about ourselves. And I think that that's the journey that the forester, the principal human character, really, really undertakes.
You made me think of the moment when the vixen becomes pregnant by the fox. They say, oh, I guess we have to get married now. That's a perfect example of a sort of imposing our morality or our mores on the world.
It's so funny. I mean, there's so many details like that that are just, and they're so silly, actually, you know. When the fox is courting the vixen, you know, they asks if she likes to smoke, you know, and if the vixen says, I'm a modern woman, you know. it's full of these details. And I think it's a way of kind of highlighting it in a way. It's, of course, it's satirizing it, but just highlighting the fact that this is our perspective of nature. Like, of course, foxes are not smoking tobacco, you know. Of course, they're not getting married, you know. Of course, there's all of these details about it, but we look at these characters and then we learn about ourselves. We see these animals and we learn about human nature.
Roberto, you've all had mentioned at the top that he was surprised when he made it to Detroit. We had not done Janacek's score. I'm wondering, what does this mean for the orchestra? Are there certain challenges? Are there certain things that have to look forward to as we prepare, as you prepare the orchestra to play this particular score?
Many challenges. And it's hard to really rank what the hardest opera is, but this is one of the hardest operas for the orchestral musicians. It's truly very difficult music in many ways. I think especially for the string players, it's very challenging because Janáček loved to compose in flat keys, and he would just compose music that was incredibly difficult and at times not completely idiomatic for the instruments, just to create different sounds. And you can see that throughout. I mean, even if the very famous recordings with the very best orchestras sometimes have issues in a lot of the places because it's very difficult. Famously, the conductor that premiered the piece, František Neumann, in one of the many orchestral rehearsals that they had, he grabbed the score and threw it to the ground and told Janáček, "This is impossible to play," and stormed out of the room. And so whenever you know the people that have played this piece know the real difficulty of it. However, I think that there's a great payment at the end of the rainbow. You know, so going through all of this trouble, there are sounds in this piece that are unlike any other piece, and soundscapes and sound worlds that are completely unique and beautiful. And so I think all of that work, that hard work is worth it, because I think the people that have never listened to a Janáček piece are in for a real treat, because the music is very accessible, very beautiful, but also they're going to hear sounds that they've never heard before. Beautiful, unique sounds.
I remember when we did Elektra a few years back, they were trying to squeeze all the folks into the pit. Is it a bigger orchestra required for this piece?
This is it's a pretty standard size romantic orchestra. I would say similar to a Puccini orchestra with more percussion. The only exception is that instead of three flutes, we have four flutes, and two of them double on piccolo. And actually, the piccolo has a very, very substantial part to play in this piece. And there are several parts where Janáček marked like an ocarina. So going back to this sort of folk sound that you've always talking about, that's spot on, because actually it's interesting because it's not quite like your Stravinsky folk, you know, where, you know, the musicologist will tell you that the Rite of Spring is full of, you know, 74 different folk tunes, and you're sitting there and you're listening and you say, well, I can't pick one out. I mean, other than that bassoon solo at the beginning, which is clearly a folk tune, you can sort of feel it viscerally that it's folk music. But in this piece, Janáček uses five very well-known folk tunes. And when you hear them, you hear them. It's very clear. So, for example, the very first entrance of Harasta, which is, I mean, to call him a villain is kind of, there's no real villain, I think, in the piece. I mean, they're just people with imperfect characters, I would say. You know, they all have their flaws. And spoiler alert, I mean, he is the only one that kills someone in the opera. But when he comes into the scene, he's singing a folk tune. And it's very, very obvious that it's a folk tune. Everyone in the audience will know. In the bar scene also, when the forester is making fun of the schoolmaster, that little folk theme is very clearly... So when you're in the audience, you'll really be able to get that element.
Yeah. Is the music, Roberto, different, say, motifs from the animals as opposed to the humans, whether it's the parsons or, like you said, the forester?
Yes. Yes. But also, they're very clear-cut motives, but it's not quite like a Wagnerian leitmotif. So, you know, this is written 40 years after Wagner's last opera, 20 years after Strauss's Salome. So it's kind of a blend of... So, for example, a Wagnerian leitmotif, you know, that Wotan will speak about, you know, the gods and Valhalla, and then immediately the brass comes in with his very famous leitmotif, and you know that it's exactly about that he's talking about. He could, you know, he could even just say the words without a clear melody, and the orchestra just tells you this is what it's about. The motives in this are more malleable, so he writes in a very organic way. So, for example, in the very first scene with the forester, the violins play this very sort of lush, leaping thing that goes, it was very long and kind of wobbly like this, and it's lyrical. You later realize that it's kind of the danger theme for the fox in Act 3, but you don't know it in the beginning. So he's using that material in an organic way so that you've heard it before, but not necessarily to identify like the Jaws theme, you know, that the shark is coming. You know, it's not always like that. But yeah, certain characters have certain motifs that are always for them, but he manipulates it to use it in different contexts too. So that's really, it's one of the most organic pieces that I've ever studied in my life. Like every single thing that is in it has come from some place before, and it's intertwined, and it's truly a compositional masterpiece.
I never noticed that connection, Roberto. After so many years of doing this piece, I hadn't thought about the connection between that music at the beginning and the music in Act 3. I mean, for me, like, I've thought about the music less connected to characters and more connected to nature. You know, like, I feel like he really takes us through so many seasons, and I feel like that's what I really wanted to try and convey with the animation too, is that we move through the cyclical nature of nature, the cyclical reality, I should say, of nature, that the seasons repeat and that there's death and then a new birth. Like, that is really at the core of what this opera is all about. And I've always felt that the thematic material always feels larger than any individual character somehow. Obviously, he characterizes his many characters with music, but it's true that it's not like there's the theme for the vixen and the theme for the fox, but there's this kind of music that's surrounding the vixen, the music that's surrounding the fox, and music surrounding the forester, and so on. And so I find that also, that he's creating a musical level that's higher than what his characters are operating in.
I thought of a moment, you were talking about the cycle of life. I thought, you know, vixen sort of, you know, is killed in the opera. And I thought, oh, that's so weird. But I guess that's another part of that natural cycle of life. We're born and we live and we die and we keep going, as the forester, you know, experiences at the end.
Yeah, I think a lot about the Disney movie Bambi a lot when I think about this, because in many ways, there are a lot of similarities. And I remember seeing Bambi as a kid, and when Bambi's mother dies in like very early on, I mean, it's as a kid, it's really traumatic. But there is something about that is just what it means to be in nature. And in the case of the opera, different from the Disney movie, there's no sentimentality at all when the vixen dies. I mean, it's an incredibly sudden thing. And you expect, like in opera, you expect some sort of final aria or something for the vixen. You know, you expect her to be able to sing goodbye. But no, she gets shot and the opera moves on. And that is really, that's part of what is surprising, maybe shocking about the opera, actually, is just how blunt it is about these things. There's a real wisdom to that and a real truth to that, is there's, you know, nature, as beautiful as it is, there is something about it that's also a little merciless, you know? I always kind of grapple with that scene where the vixen dies, you know?
I was looking at some pictures from the production, and I was reminded whether we're looking at the Valkyries, which we did a couple of seasons back, or this, technology is becoming an important mechanism in so much of the work that's coming out now. Is that a coincidence? Can you talk about that, sort of this mechanism of technology now that we seem to be seeing?
Yeah, I mean, opera actually has always deployed the latest technologies in creating the feeling of going into another universe, or bringing the audience into something that they've never seen before. You know, and from the earliest days of opera, this was almost a demand that there would be scenic spectacle as part of what opera is all about. And you would see these theaters, you know, in Italy in the 17th century that would be just competing against each other for developing new technologies to astonish their audience and sell more tickets, you know, by doing this kind of thing. So I think that there is something inherent in opera about wanting to create something that's never been seen before. And of course, there's a really direct line from there to the works of Wagner and the like. The idea that the technologies that we employ in the theater can be something that creates that sense of another world. And I think that that's, to me, an amazing thing about opera. You know, I think we sometimes think about opera as an old-fashioned way of telling stories. But I'd like to think of opera as actually always using the latest technology to help us tell stories and create narrative experiences in totally new ways.
Roberto, I was wondering if you could just talk a bit about some of the cast. I know Manet is the vixen, and Michael Samuel, who was so fantastic in Xerxes last season. Could you talk about all the characters, particularly the lead characters, if you would?
Sure. I think Yuval is tired of me saying this, but I do think that we have the best cast for Cunning Little Vixen anywhere in the world. I don't think there's a theater that you know even gets close to us. And Manet Galoyan is the vixen. Obviously, I'm biased because she's my wife, but you know, she's singing all over the world, and this was the perfect project to bring her on. The miracles of the schedules worked, and so we have her here. She's lyric soprano, incredible actress, incredible musician. Her background is in piano. She was a concert pianist before she sang, so she really, I think, audiences are going to be able to enjoy her musicality and her dramatic portrayal very, very much. Sam Hankey is the fox, and she just had a big sort of splash. She just sang Stefano and Romeo and Juliet at the Met. It was fantastic. She's singing all over the world again. A very luxurious fox, beautiful, rich voice, wonderful actress as well. And our forester is Michael Samuel, who was with us for Xerxes. And these are all role debuts, by the way. So no one has ever heard these people sing these roles, which is super exciting for me, and I think should be for everyone. Michael has this bombastic, beautiful voice, and he is dynamite on stage. And I think the forester really needs this sort of playfulness, but it has some depth, you know? It's a profound character that goes through all these. Really, we see the changes go through the forester, but also the other roles. You know, we have Alex Rosen singing Parson's Badger. We have David Cangelosi singing Schoolmaster Mosquito. Andrew Potter singing Harashta. Rihanna Thelwell singing Forrester's Wife. And we have some of our resident artists also singing roles in the piece. So it's really, I was recently in Munich and in Vienna, and I was talking to some of these casting directors over there and just telling them about this project, and they're just wide-eyed. You know, they want to come to Detroit to watch this because it's out of this world good. So I'm counting the days to start that music rehearsal. I can't wait.
Fantastic. Did you want to weigh in anything on the cast at all, Yuval?
Oh, I'm just so excited to work with each of these artists. I mean, I've been wanting to work with Mani just for as long as I've heard about her. So I am, and she is going to be so perfect for this role, which really requires an actor like Manet that has this kind of quicksilver way of thinking about things, you know, like you can see every thought that crosses her mind, you know, and then she puts that all into her singing too. And in a piece like this, where, you know, we're going to be seeing primarily their faces for most of their performance, you know, she's actually someone who could very convincingly portray a fox. So if I knew I was working with her from the beginning, we might have redone a different concept, you know? And I feel that way about Sam Hankey too, who I also have just admired so much. And she's such a commanding actor too. For their love scene, which to me is the great, I mean, there's so many great scenes in the piece, but the two great scenes, in my opinion, are the scene between the fox and the vixen, this love scene, which, because the two of them have this kind of transcendental love experience, that they transcend the animal body, it feels, and go into someplace brand new, they do emerge from behind the wall and have that scene as full-bodied singers. And I just cannot wait for the two of them to go into that. I mean, Sam is, yeah, she's such a star, and we're all going to wish that part of the fox was longer. you know, I think we'll all say, oh, give her an aria. Give her another big aria, please. We want to hear more of her. And the other crucial scene in the opera is the final one for the forester. And Michael, I've been so in awe of Michael's work. You know, he actually did, in addition to being on the stage with us in Xerxes and just completely commanding our attention when he was here for Xerxes, you know, he also did one of the roles in Malcolm X. He did Reginald and Malcolm X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, Anthony Davis's opera at the Met. And so it was just so great to see him embody that role. you know, on the stage of the Met from our production. So I'm sure he's going to deliver this final scene, which is the Foresters' kind of dream reflection on the cycle of life. A scene that is so overwhelmingly beautiful that Janáček chose it to be the scene to play at his funeral. I mean, it's overwhelmingly beautiful music and really takes a singer with the kind of gravitas and the kind of beauty of tone that I think Michael absolutely possesses. So yeah, I'm totally in agreement with Roberto that this cast is going to be just about as perfect as can be.
Fantastic. Can I take you back for one question, Yuval, back to 2014? Has your opinion or your approach changed in 2024 as opposed to when this actually debuted? Have you changed anything, or have you kept everything exactly the same? Or,
I mean, I am unlikely to change very much. The only thing I'm going to want to do is really make sure that each of these performers find the way to make these characters their own. You know, it's very much how this piece was conceived, is that, you know, I'm not trying to rob the singers of their bodies if they're playing animals. I'm actually trying to liberate them from needing to feel like they have to do some sort of animal thing, you know, and go to the zoo and study animal behavior and that kind of thing, you know, which to me is not the point of the piece at all. And I really wanted to free the singers up so that they can create a characterization that is really meaningful to them. Again, when it was done in a concert hall, that's what it's all about. You know, it's all about what is this individual artist bringing to this to this character and this role. I wanted to find the best way to do that, you know, that could also convey the world of this piece to the audience, but not have the singers feel encumbered in a physicality that will feel so foreign to them, you know, that they can actually ideally connect with the naturalness. I mean, I think if we do this right, as complicated as it is with the Czech and the rapid fire music that really does not stand still ever, you know, if we do it right, it'll feel completely natural. Like what Roberto said about it being totally organic, it's like that's the quality that we're all after, is it just feeling like completely spontaneous, you know? And that's a tall order with a piece that's as intricate as this one is, you know? But we have the cast to do it, for sure.
I can't think of a better way to finish our conversation today. Thank you so much, Yuval Sharon and Roberto Kalb. We can't wait to see this performance.
Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you, Arthur.
I also had the opportunity to chat with the professor of performing vocal arts. He joined the faculty of the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and he serves as music director of Opera Workshop. He is an associate faculty member of the university's Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies, and he teaches a Czech vocal literature course for singers and pianists. He has performed recitals as a collaborative pianist in 18 countries on 4 continents. His book, Singing in Czech, has been proclaimed as a setting of new and very welcomed high standards for teaching lyric diction. Dr. Timothy Cheek, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I must first ask you, can you tell us, where were you born and raised?
Oh, I was born in Dallas, Texas, and I was raised there. I went directly from there to the Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio.
And at 7 years old, did you turn to your parents and say, Mom and Dad, I want to be a Czech expert? How did that go about?
No, but looking back, there were many Czech immigrants in Texas, and many of my classmates had Czech last names. In the town of West, it's called West in Texas, there was published the only Czech language newspaper, actually, in the country. There was actually a lot of Czech around me at the time. But I do have to say, I remember I was 6 years old. I was taking piano lessons. I loved music. But I also loved this one class. I think a lot of people will be surprised about this. And it was called phonics. And I remember the teacher talking about different sounds in English and the spelling of that. And I was so excited. And I rushed home to tell my parents all about it. So
wow.
So years, that was the beginning. So years later, that's what I do, music and the sounds of language.
Now, I know very well during this podcast so far, I've been mispronouncing the name of the composer of The Cunning Little Vixen. Can you set the record straight for us here?
Yeah, sure. So Czech has, it's very, very interesting. The stress for every word in Czech is always on the first syllable. So Jana Čech's name. The stress is on the ya. But Čech has short vowels and long vowels that have nothing to do with stress. They're completely independent. So the second syllable in his name is long. So we actually get a syncopation. Ba ba ba. Short, long, short is his name. Jana Čech.
Jana Čech. I got to practice that. Good. I posed this question to our conductor in the earlier segment, Roberto Kaub, that often in the U.S., you know, when doing these family-friendly operas, we'll do it in English. And I'm thinking of pieces like Hansel and Gretel. But when I learned this piece would be in Czech, I happened to read out Janáček's credo that musical sounds are derived from pitches and rhythms of the speech. And then I realized maybe this made sense to keep this in Czech. Could you maybe weigh in on that?
Yes. Janáček's musical style is very, very unique. There are two main traits that make it unique. One is he spent years traveling around the Moravian countryside. Moravia is the east part of modern-day Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia in his time. And that's where he was from. And he absorbed the folk music of this region, and it became infused into his style. He didn't actually quote folk tunes, but he was able to create his own folk-like music, and you hear some of that in the opera. And the other thing that makes his style so unique is he also traveled across the countryside, just listening to people and also animals, and trying to jot down their, not just their inflection and capture that in pitches, not just the inflection, but the emotions behind their words at that particular moment. So this became very much a part of his music, especially in The Cunning Little Vixen. When people speak on pitches, it sounds very natural, and it captures the inflection of the Czech language and the emotions of the moment. So to do this in another language, it's a little bit further removed from that. Yeah, gotcha. And if I can go further, if you don't mind.
Please.
Janáček was one of the very, very first composers to write an opera to a prose libretto instead of a versified libretto with, you know, certain rhythms and rhyme schemes. The dialogue is very natural. And this also means that the opera, most of the opera, takes place in real time rather than stretched out musical time. So it becomes very modern, very, very like cinema almost, right? And it has moments of stretched out lyricism and beautiful orchestral interludes, but most of it is in real time.
Fantastic. So, you know, busy doings for you. You're also coaching the chorus and the principals in our production at the Detroit Opera. Could you talk about some of the challenges of doing that, or maybe have there been any surprises working with singers around this language?
Yeah. Well, singers always amaze me. They have wonderful, wonderful ears, and they're used to what are their tongues doing, what are their lips doing, and they're able to pick it up pretty quickly. So there's a children's chorus of little foxes. There are also a few insects and little animals here and there. They're really doing very well, just picking it up well. One of the challenges, too, is this: the quality of Czech are the long vowels and the short vowels, which you really have to tend to, because if you pronounce a vowel too long or too short or something, it can change the word from singular to plural, or it can change the meaning completely. So you have to be careful with the length. And Janáček, most of the time, he will notate a note longer if it's long and shorter if it's short, but not always. They're always with the conductor on the main beats, but in between the beats, sometimes they need to bend the rhythms a little bit. That's another one of the challenges, but they're doing great. They sound fantastic.
Is there a difference as between working with the children's chorus as opposed to the adults?
Just in energy? Otherwise, no. The children range in age from 9 to 18, and they're all fantastic and so excited.
They probably don't even realize this is supposed to be hard, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
Dr. Timothy Chi, thank you so much for joining us today. This was quite a treat.
My pleasure. I enjoyed this very much.
And thank you to everyone listening to our glimpse into Detroit Opera's production of The Cunning Little Vixen. We hope to see you at the Detroit Opera House for this exciting production, which opens May 11th and runs through May 19th at the Detroit Opera House. To purchase tickets to The Cunning Little Vixen or find more information about the production, visit our website at detroitopera.org. You can also connect with us on socials or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. We appreciate your likes. You can listen to previous episodes of Opera Here podcasts going back several seasons. Thanks to Jake Neer and Matthew Precipe for their assistance in producing this podcast, and we'll see you at the opera.